This podcast contains graphic content and discusses themes of violence. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Hi, listeners. Welcome back. You are listening to The Living Podcast, where the dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about. I'm your host, Jen Hansen, and today's case is about a young teenage girl who fell victim to people she trusted. Teenage boys who dreamed of fame as cold-blooded killers. This is episode 5, and the case of the murder of Cassie Jo Stoddart. Cassie Jo Stoddart was 16 years old in 2006, attending Pocatello High School in Idaho. She was an avid artist, and like any teenage girl, she used music to express herself and her feelings. Born December 21st, 1989, Cassie was a brilliant girl described by her friends and family as being a good kid who was always smiling. I reached out to a Facebook page I found called Tori Adamczyk is Guilty. Spoilers. And this was a page run by a friend of Cassie's. Here's what she said to me when I asked for a more personal perspective of her. Quote, Cassie was your everyday small town girl. She loved her family and her friends. She loved her boyfriend, Matt. She loved going to school. She was funny. That's something they don't mention is how funny she was. She was good at making those she loved laugh. She was quiet. Unless you knew her, then she would tell you anything. End quote. It's true that Cassie was friends with everyone, something that she was loved for, but also something that would prove to be fatal. On September 22, 2006, Cassie made the trip after school with her overnight bag from her parents' house to 11372 West Whispering Cliffs Drive, where her aunt and uncle, Frank and Allison Contreras, lived with their daughter, Cassie's cousin. They were going out of town for the weekend and had asked Cassie to stay at their home while they were gone to watch their pets and take care of the house. Though she was feisty and had an attitude like all teenage girls do, Cassie was a responsible 16-year-old, and her family all knew they wouldn't need to worry about her staying there by herself. But perhaps they should have. When Cassie arrived at the home on Whispering Cliffs Drive, she settled in and then called her boyfriend, Matthew Beckham, to come over and watch a movie with her. Cassie's family knew and loved Matt, and it was determined ahead of time that he was welcome to spend time there with her each day. As Cassie and Matt were lounging on the couch, there was a knock at the door. Unbeknownst to Cassie, Matt had invited two of their friends, Tori Adamczyk and Brian Draper, over, telling them there would be a party at the house. There was no party, however. When Matt invited Tori and Brian over, they initially declined until Matt mentioned it would be a party. Frustrated that they were invited over without her permission, but also not wanting to be rude, Cassie reluctantly showed them around the house. The tour took them through the main level, upstairs to the bedrooms, and finally downstairs to the basement. When the four teens returned to the living room, they sat down to watch Kill Bill 2, but an hour into the film, Tori and Brian decided they were bored and left to watch a movie at the nearby movie theater. Cassie and Matt continued watching Kill Bill for approximately 15 minutes before the power shut off through the entire house. Obviously startled, Matt and Cassie hoped it was a fluke and that the power would come back on soon. And it did, before going off again. Trying to be brave for Cassie, Matt decided he would go check out the rest of the house to see if he could figure out what was going on. But when the two heard the Contreras dog barking and growling at the top of the basement stairs, Matt decided to stay by Cassie. Matt decided to call his mom and asked if he could stay the night with her. Cassie was shaken up, and Matt, being a good boyfriend, didn't want to leave her alone. Matt's mom denied the request for him to stay there unsupervised. They were, after all, 16-year-olds, but said Cassie could stay the night at the Beckham house. Being the mature and responsible kid she was, Cassie declined the offer, stating she had promised to stay and take care of the pets. The power came back on shortly after that, and Matt's mother came to pick him up around 10:30. Unbeknownst to both Matt and Cassie, before Brian and Tori left the Contreras home, Brian had excused himself to use the bathroom and unlocked the basement door. When Matt was leaving, he called up Brian to see where he was to resume hanging out. Brian whispered that he was in a movie, and Matt told him they would just meet up tomorrow. Unknowingly, Matt had just sealed Cassie's fate. And now, alone in the house, Cassie settled in hoping no other incidents would come up. But then the power went out again. Not wanting to investigate alone, Cassie stayed on the couch in the dark. It was silent until she heard glass break in the basement, followed by more silence before the slamming of the basement door. Let's take a moment now to talk about Brian and Tori. Brian Draper was born in Utah, where he spent most of his life until his parents moved to Pocatello. Brian had a MySpace page, and hopefully you're all old enough to remember what that is, where he frequently talked about suicide and murder. It also showcased his interest in the Columbine shooters. It was well known amongst his immediate family that he was a pretty troubled kid. In the spring of 2006, Brian became friends with Tori Adamczyk. According to Tori's parents, Tori was a good kid who never got into any trouble, which we'll get into. His parents are a bit problematic, as you'll come to find out. Regardless, Tori and Brian bonded over their mutual love of Slipknot, and both were huge movie buffs, especially when it came to horror movies. In fact, the two decided to begin writing a horror screenplay that featured two teenage killers. So we all see where this is going, right? In fact, Brian was known for carrying around a video camera and taping. Yes, taping, not filming. This was 2006, remember? He would videotape his friends and often film himself and Tori driving around in the car talking about typical teenage angst. Although in their case, it really wasn't that typical. Now let's go back to September 22nd, when Cassie was alone in the house, in the dark, and heard glass shattering and a door slammed shut. Honestly, I can't even imagine what that sweet girl was feeling all by herself. She stayed on the couch in the pitch black darkness. I can only guess, paralyzed in fear. Most people tend to have a fight or flight reaction, but something that isn't talked about very often is the freeze response in traumatic situations. Now, before I go any further, I would just like to say, I am not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but I am a forensic psychology student, and I've done a lot of research for this episode. According to psychologist Dr. Leon F. Seltzer, the freeze response can actually be one of the safest ways to react to certain dangers. We all know that the fight response is when your body produces enough adrenaline to boost you into a mode where you feel confident and safe enough to defend yourself against whatever you're facing. Conversely, the flight response also engages your adrenaline, but without the hormone-fueled drive of the fight response. It's only enough to encourage your body to get out of the situation safely. The freeze response, however, is a way your brain chooses to dissociate. Dr. Seltzer writes of this response, quote, "Being physically, mentally, and emotionally immobilized by your consternation permits you to not feel the harrowing enormity of what's happening to you, which in your hyper-aroused state might threaten your very sanity. In such instances, some of the chemicals you thereby secrete, i.e. endorphins, function as an analgesic, so the pain of injury to your body or psyche is experienced with far less intensity." End quote. And this response for Cassie is truly the best thing her body could have chosen to do. Because not long after the broken glass and slammed basement door, two dark figures emerged up the stairs and stabbed Cassie Jo Stoddart to death. The autopsy findings concluded the first stab wound was fatal. So if we consider what Dr. Seltzer says on the freeze response, we can hope that Cassie's suffering was minimal.
September 22nd to 26, we're skipping by 48 hour. We're not even applying right now. I'm telling Cassie's family, but she had to go to work. We have to stick with the plan. And she's perfect, so she's gonna die.
What you just heard was Brian and Tori talking about their plan to murder Cassie just hours before they actually did. Though Brian does the bulk of the talking, you can faintly hear Tori say, quote, "I'm making our death list." The video can be found on YouTube, which is far more chilling to watch than to hear, as you can see their young 16-year-old faces. It truly is harrowing. When the Contreras family came home Sunday afternoon, Frank and Allison's daughter was the first in the house and the one to find Cassie's body. The living room scene was a bloodbath and prompted a 911 call from Cassie's aunt Allison. When police arrived at the Stoddart home to break the news to her mother Anna, they asked if she could think of anyone that might want to harm Cassie. The first name she could give them was that of Matthew Beckham. Police went straight to the Beckham household to break the news to him. Matt told police he had called Cassie a few times the Saturday after he left her aunt's house, but couldn't get a hold of her. He hung out with Brian that day instead and asked him to take Matt to the Contreras house to check on his girlfriend, but Brian's response was that he didn't have enough gas to make the long drive. The police officer thought it was odd that Matt didn't have much of a reaction to Cassie's murder. For just learning his girlfriend had died, he seemed pretty unaffected and emotionless. However, upon passing a polygraph test he agreed to take, he was ultimately cleared. But his recount of Friday night took police right to Brian Draper and Tori Adamczyk. Police conducted home interviews with both the teens at their individual homes on the same Sunday Cassie's body was discovered. Brian and Tori gave nearly identical accounts of what they did Friday night. According to police records, the two left the Whispering Cliffs residence around 9:45 p.m. and drove to Carmike Theaters. They paid cash for tickets to see the movie Pulse, but couldn't identify which of the theaters inside the building was where they watched the movie. Brian added an additional detail, stating one of their classmates, a girl named Heather, was working that night and spoke to them, assumingly trying to give them a witness to corroborate their story. Brian and Tori both said they hadn't heard about Cassie's death until police informed them. The following Tuesday, September 26th, police conducted a second interview with Brian Draper at the Pocatello Police Department, where both of his parents were in attendance. In this interview, he admitted the story about the movie theater was made up, and instead said they left the Contreras home around 9:45 that Friday, changing into dark clothing and putting on gloves to, quote, go through and burglarize cars in the area. Brian said they didn't see anything valuable, so they didn't bother to take anything. He also couldn't give an exact area as to where they were breaking into cars, nor could he provide any make or model of the cars that they supposedly got into. At that point, Brian agreed to take a polygraph. The following day, Brian and his parents returned to the police department to take his scheduled polygraph test. It was at this point that Brian requested to speak privately with his parents. The family stepped outside to have a private discussion, and when they returned, Brian's father was in tears. No polygraph had been taken. Brian was Mirandized and then told the full story. The following comes exclusively from the official affidavit of probable cause in support of criminal complaint/citation, found in the court records from Brian Draper's trial. This report was taken by Bannock County Detective Andy Thomas, Detective Sergeant Scott Marchand, and Lieutenant John Gansky. Quote, on September 22, 2006, Brian Draper and Tori Adamczyk went into the residence where Matt and Cassie were on Whispering Cliffs Drive. They visited with Matt and Cassie for a while and then left the residence. They got into Tori's vehicle, the red 1994 Geo, and drove down the street a short distance from the Whispering Cliffs residence. They pulled over and parked, they got out of the vehicle, and they proceeded to put on costumes that consisted of dark shirts, gloves, and masks. They each also grabbed a knife. They drove back and parked just to the east of the residence of Whispering Cliffs, where Matt and Cassie were located with their costumes on and knives in hand. They looked through the windows of the residence prior to entering the residence through the basement door on the south side of the residence. They walked around in the basement making some noise, trying to get Cassie and Matt to come downstairs so they could scare them. They threw some objects on the floor of the basement, breaking them, in an attempt to get Cassie and Matt to come downstairs. They found the panel box and turned the lights off in the residence. After a while, they turned the power back on. They heard Matt's mother arrive and pick up Matt. They turned the power off again after Matt left with his mother, and they proceeded to walk upstairs. At the top of the stairs, he opens and slams a closet door in an attempt to scare Cassie. The Contreras dog came out to them and then ran back into the living room where Cassie was. They walked into the living room, and Cassie was lying on the couch. She jumps to her feet and asks them who they are. Tori was in front of him, walking toward Cassie. Cassie says she is going to kick their asses. He hears Cassie scream and then sees Tori stab Cassie several times. Cassie goes to the ground and he hears a snoring/gurgling sound. Tori turns to him and says, "I don't know what I have done. We have to kill her." Tori goes back to Cassie and stabs her several more times. They then left the residence. They drive in Tori's car back to Tori's house where they stayed for a while. They go into the garage of Tori's house and get a blue garbage sack from the garage and put the costumes and knives they had on when Cassie was killed into the sack. They get a bottle of rubbing alcohol from Tori's house and go to Tori's car, throw the bag with the knives and the costumes in the back of Tori's car. They leave Tori's residence and drive to the Common Sense located at Highline and Alameda in Pocatello, Bannock County, Idaho. He goes into the Common Sense and purchases some matches. They drive out to either the Mink Creek area or the Black Rock Canyon area. They walk up a trail for a ways and then burn the bag with the costumes and the knives. He is not sure, but Tori may have buried what remained after the fire. Tori had on high-top Converse tennis shoes and black jeans at the time Cassie is killed, and they do not burn those. The shirt, pants, and shoes he was wearing at the time Cassie was killed were not burned either. They then drove back to Tori's residence at 1598 Point View in Pocatello, Bannock County, Idaho, and watched a video. End quote. After giving police that statement, Brian agreed to take detectives to the burn site where they ultimately located the burned bag. Uncovered were the costumes, four knives, a videotape, and a letter that was partially burned. Detectives did their best to recover what was left of the letter and were able to read the following. Quote, Brian is gonna to kill Cassie, home alone, stop, runs into Tori, we murder, Cassie is home alone, house, Brian kills his on the back porch, his body on the back porch, house, Brian has, and we kill her, killing Matt, end quote. The following is from the video recovered from the burn site. For reference, the higher pitched voice you hear first is Tori. His voice is pretty distinct between the two of them, so every time you hear the higher of the two speaking, that's who it is.
There should be no law against killing people. I know it's a wrong thing, but hell, you restrict somebody from it, they're gonna want it more.
We found our victim, and sad as it may be, she's our friend. But you know what? We all have to make sacrifices. Our first victim is going to be Cassie's daughter. She's going to be alone in a big, dark house out in the middle of nowhere. How perfect can you get? I mean, like, holy shit, dude.
I'm horny just thinking about it.
Hell yeah. It was 9:50, September 22nd, 2006. We know there's lots of doors. There's lots of places to hide. I locked the back doors. That's all locked. Now we just gotta wait. I just killed Cassie. We just left her house. This is not a fucking joke.
I'm shaking.
I stabbed her in the throat and I saw her lifeless body just disappear. Dude, I just killed Cassie. Oh, fuck. That felt like fucking real. I mean, it went by so fast.
Shut the fuck up. We gotta get our act straight.
Okay.
Note here, it's Brian who says, quote, I just killed Cassie, and quote, I stabbed her in the throat. It's a pretty indicative contrast from what was in his so-called confession. The following day, September 27th, 5 days after Cassie's death, Tori Adamczyk returned to the police station with his parents and was Mirandized. Tori, however, decided to sign a Miranda rights waiver. The following comes exclusively from the official affidavit of probable cause in support of criminal complaint / citation found in the court records from Tori Adamczyk's trial. This report was taken by Bannock County Detective Andy Thomas, Sergeant Scott Marchand, and Lieutenant John Gansky. Quote, that in the previous interview, he lied about going to the movie Pulse with Brian Draper after leaving the residence located at 11372 Whispering Cliffs on Friday, September 22nd, 2006. He and Brian Draper left 11372 Whispering Cliffs between 9:35 p.m. and 9:40 p.m., at which time they drove a short distance away from the residence on Whispering Cliffs and got out of the car and began going through cars in the area in an attempt to burglarize them. He and Draper went through approximately 3 cars that were unlocked, obtaining only a small amount of change. He tried the door handles on several other cars in the area, but they were locked. He could not specifically identify any of the vehicles he burglarized. He did, however, recall making 3 cellular telephone calls to Matt Beckham and Cassie Stoddart at 11372 Whispering Cliffs. He spoke to Beckham, and the general conversations were concerning Beckham helping them go through cars and needing a ride to his house. He said that Beckham told him his mother was coming to pick him up soon to go home and would not be helping them. After burglarizing cars in the area of Whispering Cliffs, he and Draper drove directly to his residence at 1598 Point View, arriving home at approximately 11:30 p.m. Once at home, he and Draper watched the movie Saving Silverman, then went to sleep around 2 a.m. on September 23, 2006. When confronted about he and Draper leaving his residence without permission once they arrived home for the evening, he admitted that they did leave. At approximately 1:30 a.m., they drove to the Common Sense convenience store located at the corner of Alameda and Highline, where Draper purchased a box of stick matches. Draper purchased the matches because he was a smoker, but he does not know what brand of cigarettes he smokes. Before leaving his house at 1:30 a.m., he loaded a shovel into the trunk which belonged to Draper. He probably had a Halloween-type mask in his trunk that he purchased a while ago. He and Draper drove to the area of Black Rock Canyon, which is located south of Pocatello near Century High School, where they parked and got out of the car. Draper smoked 2 cigarettes and he urinated. He believed that Draper may have taken the shovel out of the trunk, but does not remember if he dug the dirt with the shovel. When confronted with the possibility that he and Draper killed Cassie Stoddart earlier in the evening, he stated he would like to speak with his attorney. At this time, the interview was terminated with Adamczyk, and we told him we would not be asking him any further questions, and he was going to be taken into custody and charged with first-degree murder. His father, Sean Adamczyk, asked Tori the following question. Quote, "This is right, Tori? What they're saying is true?" Tori Adamczyk responded to his father's question by stating, "Yeah." Sean Adamczyk responded to Tori's response by saying, quote, "It sounds like you need a lawyer then. What can I say?" End quote. As far as trials go, this one happened quickly. Both Tori and Brian were originally set to be tried together, but both defense attorneys fought to have them separated. In the legal world, there are a few reasons this is such a big deal for duos of criminals. One of the reasons is that if one of them seems more guilty than the other, it can cast a shadow onto the less guilty one. There is also good reason for wanting them to be separate when it comes to inadmissible evidence. If there is evidence against one that is ruled inadmissible for one defendant, but they are tried together, it can still be shown in the trial for the other defendant, even though the jury will have instruction to only consider that evidence for the one applicable defendant. We're all still humans, and we are flawed in the sense that our brains typically don't separate it. Ultimately, the trials were separated, and the hearings began. Tori's attorney tried to file a motion for sealing of the court records and to have a gag order placed on the case, but the judge ultimately denied it. Some of the reasons that were listed to have it sealed and a gag order in place were pretty typical, such as media coverage often spins stories to gain readership or to help minimize coverage so that they can more easily find an unbiased jury without moving the trial to another jurisdiction. However, two of the reasons I found quite entertaining were, one, there were news stories that said listening to the violent lyrics of Slipknot brainwashed them into murdering Cassie. And two, Tori was being linked in the media to an earlier unsolved murder. I'm going to spoil it for you here and now. He was cleared of that, although it was years after he was already in prison and actually had to stand trial for it. He ended up being cleared when DNA evidence collected from the scene could be later tested and linked to the actual killer. Both teenagers, now 17 years old, were tried as adults. Brian's trial concluded in April of 2007, just 7 months after Cassie's murder. On April 17th, he was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Tori's trial started in May that year and concluded in August, where he was also convicted of first-degree murder and also sentenced to life in prison. Strangely so, because this is not a thing I ever thought about and didn't think prisoners, especially if they knew each other, would ride to prison together, Brian and Tori were in the van together on their way from the courthouse to prison after their sentencing. It seems a little odd, right? The Lieutenant K.G. Fonsbeck drove the pair to prison, where he told the Spokesman Review that the two chatted the whole time, even asking him to let them go because, quote, "they're just stupid kids." Right. I'm sure that worked really well for them. Fonsbeck recalled to the Review how they both reflected on how one single day changed the rest of their lives. They also told one another that they had no ill feelings toward each other after they both tried to pin the blame on one another. Solid friendship right there. So here we are. The loaded question, what makes some kids kill? And let's be clear, these were 16-year-olds. They were absolutely still kids. especially when you consider male brains don't fully develop until around the age of 24. There are a few hallmark reasons as to why these things happen. Abusive households, seeking revenge on someone who harmed them, although this is usually linked closely with the first reason and often the target is an abusive caregiver. It's also rare to see violent teenagers pair up with one another to carry out a murderous plot. To be totally clear, it's pretty rare in general to have pairs of murderers. That isn't to say it doesn't happen. Take the Ken and Barbie killers, the Columbine shooters, the Moores murders, Fred and Rose West, the list goes on. However, according to one of my favorite psychologists of all time, my personal hero, Dr. Catherine Ramsland, it's more rare to see young pairs of killers. This is often because of the possibility one will back out of the plan, or worse, turn the other in. In her article for Psychology Today titled, What Influences Kids to Become Killers?, Dr. Ramsland demonstrates that for kids who experience bullying or have a hard time making connections, quote, humiliation runs deep, depriving them of self-esteem and a sense of control. When this occurs, they can fixate on it and seek ways to restore control and exact payback, end quote. She also describes how in pairs of young killers, there is often a more dominant, controlling leader and a more submissive, insecure follower. And that's exactly how the media portrayed Brian and Tori. News outlet after news outlet painted Brian Draper as the ringleader, the psychotic mastermind with a bloodlust, while Tori Adamczyk was described as a good student who was lonely and got sucked into Brian's twisted ways. Tori's parents are also incredible enablers. Years after both teens' incarceration, they still deny very publicly that Tori is guilty. Here's the thing, though. Court documents detail that two different knives were used in the killing of Cassie Jo Stoddart. One was a curved, smooth blade, and the other was a straight, serrated blade. It is not just uncommon, but non-existent. Seriously, I looked hard to find an instance of this, where a single killer uses two kinds of the same weapon. It just doesn't happen. The autopsy findings also showed that based on the locations and angles of the stab wounds, it very clearly shows two killers. And you know, if Tori waiving his Miranda rights and confessing isn't enough for them, I don't think his parents can be helped. There is also a little video they made and posted to YouTube. It doesn't have any audio. It's just text set to music. I highly recommend looking it up. It's called Advocates for Abandoned Adolescents. It will show you the absolute denial Tori's parents are in, and honestly, it's kind of funny. Cassie's death wreaked havoc on everyone around her. Her mother struggled to raise the rest of her children. Her brother Andrew, who was a year younger than her, took it the hardest. On the 10-year anniversary of her death, Andrew recalls to the Idaho Journal, quote, "Me and her were always into the same stuff and going to the same places. We did everything together, even though we would argue and stuff, just like any other sibling. I just miss having my sister right there, a grade above me. I felt like I was always a step behind her, looking up to her. She really was a role model. She was really smart, doing good, and had a lot going for her." End quote. Allison and Frank Contreras never returned to the Whispering Cliffs home after Cassie's body was discovered. The day they came home to find the crime scene, police arranged for temporary housing for them, and they never went back. The couple tried to sell the house year after year without success. In a small town where news travels quickly, no one dared purchase it, no matter how low the price dropped. According to Bannock County Recorder's documents, the house finally sold in 2015, and that family has lived there ever since. The daughter of the Contreras who found Cassie's body has had profound trouble in her life since that day. She attempted suicide a few years later and has suffered with mental breakdowns ever since. Cassie Jo Stoddart was a well-loved, bright girl with a bright future. She was a straight-A student and a friend to everyone. In her honor, the art students of Pocatello High painted a mural for her on a large rock outside the front of the school. Although Cassie is gone, her legacy will live on forever. And that, my friends, is the case of Cassie Jo Stoddart. Thank you so much for tuning in to the fifth episode of The Living. If you enjoyed listening, please head over to my page and subscribe. And if you're feeling extra generous, a rating and review would be oh so very appreciated. I even have stickers and pins that I can send you if you want to send me a screenshot showing that you've done so. For pictures pertaining to the case, head over to my Instagram at The Living Podcast, where you can also give me a follow. If you'd like to follow me on other social media platforms, you can find me on my Facebook page, The Living Podcast, or on Twitter, at The Living Pod. Feel free to send me a message with your thoughts on teenage killers or suggestions for a case you'd like to hear next. I'll be bringing you a brand new episode shortly, so stay tuned. But in the meantime, please always remember,
the dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.